This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky.
And I'm Kathleen Davis. Later in the hour, NASA's Europa Clipper has launched. We'll learn more about this Jupiter-bound spacecraft, plus playing possum and what animals know about death.
But first, big news on the cute animal front. Yes, this week, giant pandas returned to the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. Here to tell us more about this and some other big science stories from the week is Sophie Bushwick, senior news editor at New Scientist. Sophie, always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, so tell us more about these pandas who are coming back.
So these are two pandas. They're Bao Li and Xing Bao, and they have arrived at the zoo in Washington, D.C. It's very exciting because this year is the first year in decades that China has sent pandas to the U.S. Earlier this year, a couple arrived at the San Diego Zoo. And so, first of all, it's great for people who love pandas. If you're in the D.C. area, you're going to be able to check the pandas out starting in January. If you're anywhere, you can use the panda cam at the San Diego Zoo to check those pandas out. It's also good for what's called panda diplomacy, which is sort of the idea that by sending pandas to the U.S., it's a sign of goodwill from China.
Yeah, so we actually have a big story about this that we did at the end of last year at sciencefriday.com/pandas. Panda diplomacy has been going on for a very long time. I have to ask you, Sophie, how exactly do you ship a panda?
Very carefully. So there's a plane called the FedEx Panda Express. So this
is an aircraft.
Of course, you have to use the name. The pandas traveled there with some humans keeping an eye on them, and then their crates were moved to trucks, and then the trucks took them to the zoo. You could see there's pictures of pandas on the truck, so if you saw them driving by, then that's what was inside, and they made it to the zoo and were unloaded. And the reason they're not going to be on display till January is because they need some time to acclimate to their new habitat, and they're going to have human handlers, you know, helping and making sure that they're healthy and happy before they start making them available to the viewing public.
That's excellent. So we've got East Coast pandas, we've got West Coast pandas. You can now see pandas in different parts of America. So while we're talking about endangered animals, there's a company that wants to bring back some more extinct animals, and they have news this week about the thylacine. So I want you to tell us more, but first, describe exactly what a thylacine was.
So a thylacine, it was also called the Tasmanian tiger. This was a marsupial, but a meat-eating one, a predator. And it used to be living in Australia. And then by the time European explorers arrived, they were all in Tasmania. And then after a while, they all died out. The last known thylacine died in 1936. So they've been extinct for a while. And now the company Colossal says they have nearly completely sequenced the genome of this extinct animal. And Colossal is interested in de-extinction, so bringing extinct species back.
Okay, and just to be clear, this is the company saying this. This is not peer-reviewed.
That's
is
right.
Not a publication here. So, but if they do have the genome, as they say, how would you go from having the genome of this animal to actually making a new animal?
Right. I mean, it's not as easy as just, you know, popping the genome in a fresh cell. What they think the genome is going to do is help them understand more about the thylacine. But the technique that they want to actually use for bringing the thylacine back, they would modify a different marsupial species called the fat-tailed dunart, and they want to modify its genes to make it more like a thylacine. So knowing the thylacine genome is great because maybe you can put pieces of the genome in the cell, but it's also not like the end. They're not done with this process. I mean, a dunart does not look that much like a Tasmanian tiger.
but I think that's the important thing here is if you look at the dunart and you look at the thylacine, you're like, these are not even close to the same animals, are they?
Right. What you would really have is not a thylacine, but it's a weird version of a dunart. You know, it'll be a sort of like a thylacine-like dunart is what you're really going to be ending up with in the end.
Yeah, the weird thylacine dunart, the animal that nobody asked for. Yeah,
that's, yes.
Okay, so next on our list, there's some news about nut allergies and airplanes. We thought that flying was potentially dangerous for people with nut allergies with all these bags of peanuts opening up, but there's a new study out about this. What can you tell us?
Right. So for people with severe peanut allergies, just having fragments of peanut in the air can be dangerous. They can inhale it and have a life-threatening allergic reaction. And so the fear in planes was, you know, if someone with a nut allergy is anywhere on the plane, we don't want to have any nuts open because, you know, they could get into the air. But a new study actually looked at how the filters on the airplane move air around, and they found that airborne peanut fragments would not be a problem. There's not enough of it getting into the air to really hurt someone with an allergy unless they were in pretty close proximity to the person actually eating the peanuts. So, you know, if they were maybe in the same row.
Of course, but this probably doesn't mean that all the airlines are going to go back to having peanuts all the time, because it's not just the airborne peanut air, I suppose, but I don't know, there's little peanut particles everywhere, just like there's crumbs underneath the seat and in that little bag that's on the back of the seat in front of you.
I cannot eat stuck on a plane without getting crumbs, you know, on the tray, on the seat, on the floor. And if those crumbs are peanut crumbs, that could be dangerous for someone with a peanut allergy for sure.
Okay, so let's switch to sending other things through the air, and we're going to talk about wireless networks. We have a story about research into a faster way to transmit data. What can you tell us?
This is pretty cool. Researchers set a new record for sending data. They sent 938 gigabits per second. So that's roughly the equivalent of downloading 20 movies in a second. And it's 9,000 times the average speed of a 5G connection today. And the researchers achieved this by most 5G networks are operating in a pretty narrow band of frequencies. So it's limited. And the researchers expanded the size of the frequency bands that they're able to operate in by using both radio waves and light. And that's how they achieved this record. And it's possible that this could be a candidate for being the basis of futuristic 6G networks, but there are actually other potential technologies that could become the basis of 6G. So it's not certain that this will be the new version of data.
Okay, so it's possible that there's some other technology. I mean, is there a chance that this is something, though, that will be in our phones soon? Or is there just too much other development to go and, honestly, too much cost to build out a system like this?
There is a chance that this could be in our phones someday. I would not say soon, but yeah, you know, for 6G to happen, there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be built. Like you said, you have to have like phones and devices that are capable of working with it. And so this isn't something that, you know, will be coming next year, but it is cool that researchers are like, 5G is passé. We're done with it. We want 6G. We want the future. We want speeds to be even faster.
Okay, so let's blast off into space for a minute here. There are two new papers about a strange brown dwarf star. Sophie, what can you tell us?
Right. The first brown dwarf star ever found was very, very weird. So brown dwarfs are sort of like failed stars. They didn't have enough matter and they were too cool to maintain nuclear fusion. And so they kind of faded out. And in the night sky, they look more like planets than stars. And researchers found the first one in 1995. And they said, this is a really weird thing because this is a big object, right? It's like 71 times the size of Jupiter. It should be big enough to have sustained nuclear fusion. So what's going on here? Why did this star fail? It's been this mystery. And someone suggested that maybe what they're looking at isn't a single brown dwarf, but a pair of brown dwarf twins orbiting around each other. And this was really hard to confirm because of the detail you would need in the observations. But now two different research teams have done it, and they've published papers showing that what we thought was Gliese 229b is actually two brown dwarfs. It's Gliese 229ba and Gliese 229bb.
Okay, so since we're talking about intertwined fates, let's move to AI, Sophie. There's AI in everything these days. Researchers are looking at whether it can be used to develop scientific hypotheses. What can you tell us about this?
A lot of AI is really good at very specific tasks, but the question is, how good is it at, you know, going through the scientific process? So not just modeling different shapes of how proteins could fold, but, you know, developing a hypothesis and then performing an experiment to test it and analyzing the results and drawing conclusions from them. So researchers, in order to figure this out, they built what's essentially a simulator. It seems like a game. It's called Discovery World, but really it has a lot of both challenging and less challenging tasks that mimic the process of going through the scientific method and developing these experiments. And then they developed a few different AI agents. These were all based on OpenAI's GPT-4o model, but they each took a different approach to solving problems. So they weren't exactly working the same way. And they had these AIs work in the Discovery World simulator and try to do science. And then they compared them with 11 humans who either had PhDs or master's degrees in engineering or natural sciences.
Okay, so yeah, how'd the humans do?
Yeah. So humans still ahead of AI when Woo-hoo. It comes to science. Go us. In the problems, the tasks they had to solve, the AI agents solved less than 20% of them. And the humans solved about 66% of them on average. So we're still ahead of AI in this particular way.
You've got one last story for us, Sophie, and we're going to start with some sound. Let's listen. Okay, Sophie, so I know that you know what these sounds are. What do they sound like to you?
Honestly, to me, they do sound like frogs, which is what they are. However, you know, sometimes you hear what you want to hear. And when scientists listened to these frog calls, they didn't think frogs. They thought, gee, that sounds just like Star Trek sound effects to me. And this is a study. Researchers went to look at this frog species that lives in Madagascar. It's called Buphus morogenensis. And in studying it, they've realized, hey, maybe this isn't actually a single species. And they looked at the DNA and they listened to those frog calls and they realized there's actually 7 different species here. And each one has this distinct call. And these calls all sound like Star Trek sound effects to us. So let's name them after Star Trek characters.
Oh, no.
And now there are 7 new frog species named after captains of in the Star Trek. So there's Buphus Kirky in honor of James T. Kirk. And there's also frogs named after Jean-Luc Picard and Catherine Janeway and Christopher Pike.
When I listened to these frogs the first time, I thought to myself, they sound to me like frogs. But again, If you're hearing Star Trek sound effects, you know, what the heck? Name it whatever you want, right?
And if you're the one who's studying them, like, you get to name them. You have the privilege. You've put in the work. You've listened to the calls. And if what you want to name them after is Star Trek, then yeah, go ahead.
Well, Sophie, as always, thank you for bringing us such enlightening and interesting and weird stories. It's always good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Sophie Bushwick is senior news editor at New Scientist. After the break, NASA just launched a spacecraft that is headed to Jupiter's moon, Europa. We'll dig into why scientists are so excited about this mission.
This is Science Friday. I'm Kathleen Davis. On October 14th, NASA successfully launched Europa Clipper, a spacecraft that's now zooming towards Jupiter's icy moon, Europa. Space nerds are fascinated with Europa because it's thought to have a massive ocean flowing under its icy crust. The presence of water is one of the biggest clues for evidence of life beyond Earth, and Europa is one of the most promising places in the solar system to look for life. Later, we'll get into the science of the mission, but first, here to tell us about the launch is Dr. Patty Boyd, astrophysicist at NASA and co-host of the agency's podcast, Curious Universe. Welcome back to Science Friday, Patty.
Thank you so much for having me, Kathleen.
Well, tell us about this launch. How did it go?
Well, there was some drama, of course. It was actually delayed for a few days due to all of the intense hurricane activity in Florida. So that it caused lots of, angst, stress, worry, rescheduling, replanning. And so a few days later, after the skies had cleared on October 14th, 2024, the folks that were there in person and online were treated to just a beautiful, spectacular, picture-perfect launch of the Europa Clipper on a Falcon 9 Heavy. And, those things never get old to watch, to see, to listen to a launch. And it's great to see that this launch was successful. And we are on our way. Europa Clipper is on its way to Europa.
I imagine that watching any launch is very exciting and maybe a little bit nerve-wracking. What was the energy like at NASA?
Well, it really depends on your role in the mission. Of course, anybody who has worked on this mission in any role over the, last decade plus is glued to that screen and, is going to be watching minute by minute. There is a lot of anticipation and trepidation even, but also so much excitement. There's so much work and preparation and testing that goes into getting a scientific payload ready for launch. And launch is one of the most challenging episodes that it's ever going to go through. It's just a lot of energy. A lot of things can go wrong very quickly. So there it is, that like just pent up stress about what's going to happen. So many people were just, you know, really glued to either with their eyes at Kennedy or on their screens on the computer. If you're not part of the mission, then you're still really excited about it because you probably know someone who is part of the mission, or maybe you're just really interested in Europa because it's a really, really interesting place in our solar system. So lots of emotions, mostly just lots of fingers crossed, and then huge relief and happiness and joy.
So tell us about some of the scientific instruments that the spacecraft is carrying.
So the spacecraft has a variety of instruments. It's actually got a huge number of instruments, 9 instruments, and it'll be a 10th experiment. 5 of them are meant to do measurements of pictures and spectra from the surface of Europa. And the other 5 are meant to just kind of tell us what are the conditions there in the Europa environment. What's the magnetic, the radiation environment like? What about particles? It's really a great chance for all of these instruments to work together to really interrogate this body in our solar system. We're going to be like nosy neighbors dropping in every couple of weeks and really taking a look around, sniff around. They'll be able to tell us about its surface, composition. What is the geology like on this body? What about that ice crust and variations from position to position and with time? And then what's going on at the surface, under the ice crust, under that ocean that we think is, you know, has a good amount of salt, but how much? We want to know that. We want to measure that. What's the surface like? What are the interactions of these parts like? And what about how they all interact with that very punishing radiation environment around Jupiter? So it's filled with instruments. It's got massive solar arrays on it to power that whole suite of instruments. And then it will send the data down when it gets far away from Europa after those close approaches. And scientists will sift through that every couple weeks to get the fundamental data that they need and then also plan for what to do next on the next flyby.
Europa Clipper has all of this fancy science gear, but it also has something that surprised me, a really beautiful poem. So tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, thank you for bringing that up, because I think this is just such a beautiful part of the story. Ever since NASA started sending probes out into the solar system, they've taken some time to put like a human imprint on it, to send something like a message in a bottle out there, to talk about who sent this probe and why. What is humanity all about? Why are we building these things on the surface of our planet Earth? What are we learning? What are we hoping to learn? Europa Clipper follows that tradition. It has literally a message in a bottle. You know, we're throwing this spacecraft up into space to another water world, from one water world to another, just like folks throw messages in a bottle in the oceans of the Earth. So this particular message in a bottle has so much cool stuff on it, including this poem that was written by the poet laureate of the U.S., Ada Limón. And it's absolutely beautiful. You can hear her read it online if you're interested in it. But it really just touches on what is the mystery that is driving humanity to put such an amazing spacecraft in orbit around Europa and to really understand the water on that world and how important water is for humanity and what we're hoping to find in the water in Europa.
Wow, that's so lovely. Patty, what's been the most exciting part of watching this mission come together for you?
Oh boy, that is a great question. I think it's the context and where we're launching today. So it takes, you know, well over a decade to plan an enormous flagship mission like Europa Clipper. You know, in the last decade, we've had explosive growth in our understanding of planets around other stars. And we know now, you know, that the distribution of sizes of those planets is very similar to the distribution of, say, the moons and the smaller planets in our own solar system. There are bodies out there around other stars that are going to be a lot like Europa. And so while we'll be able to use Europa Clipper's data to answer really fundamental questions about things like water and chemicals and habitability in our own solar system, it's also going to have profound impacts on the possibility of habitable environments in the entire Milky Way galaxy, hundreds of billions of stars in their planetary systems, and then even beyond our own galaxy to other galaxies. So how common are these life-supporting conditions out there? I think it's a huge question that's just getting more and more exciting and important with time.
Well, what a lovely note to end on. Dr. Patty Boyd is an astrophysicist at NASA and co-host of the agency's podcast, Curious Universe. Patty, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, and go Europa Clipper.
Best send-off we've had in a while.
Awesome.
Since its start, more than 4,000 people have contributed to the Europa Clipper mission, and I'm sure they can't wait to get their hands on the data. So here to discuss the science of Europa Clipper is Dr. Ingrid Daubar, Associate Professor at Brown University and Europa Clipper Project Staff Scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, and Dr. Tracy Becker, Planetary Scientist at Southwest Research Institute and co-investigator on the Europa Clipper mission. Here's Ira Flatow.
Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Nice to have you both on the show. You both must be pretty excited about this mission, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. We're going to find out so much more about this incredible icy ocean world. And I think there's just going to be so much that we aren't even asking yet that we're going to find out. And so I'm excited for all the mysteries and all the new questions that are going to happen.
Wow. Okay. So what kind of instruments are on this mission and what do you hope to measure?
So the mission, the Europa Clipper mission has a suite of 10 scientific investigations, and they're all going to work together to answer a lot of questions about the habitability of Europa. They range from remote sensing instruments. We have all kinds of cameras that are going to observe in wavelengths ranging from the UV all the way to an ice penetrating radar. And of course, lots of visible images as well. And we also have in situ instruments that will actually sample the environment around Europa. We're going to look at its magnetic fields. We're going to sample any kind of dust or ice that's being kicked off the surface or ejected. So we're really going to investigate this moon in all of its aspects and try to figure out these questions about whether or not it actually represents a habitable environment.
Well, what would be the signatures of a habitable environment that these instruments might pick up on Europa?
Yeah, so habitability, I think it's evolved a little bit. It's not necessarily, I think, a yes or no question. It's really going to be looking at a spectrum of, are all the ingredients there that we think are necessary for life as we know it? And what does that look like? This vast liquid water ocean, but what's the salinity of it? Is it actually heated from below? Is the material at the surface that's radiation processed in contact with that liquid water ocean? And what does that chemistry look like? So we're going to be able to look at a lot of the processes that are happening at the surface and try to figure out whether that represents material exchange with the subsurface and what kind of chemistry and geology are there.
One of the exciting things about this, by looking at habitability on Europa, is that even on Earth, in some of the darkest, coldest, deepest spots in Earth's ocean, where we thought was completely inhospitable to life, we've managed to find life. And so those processes that Dr. Daubar just mentioned, you know, talking about, is there exchange, a chemical exchange, allowing, introducing energy into the system, the way that Earth has at the bottom of the Earth's oceans, would be a really exciting thing to find. And those would be keys to helping us understand whether or not this moon is potentially habitable.
Tell me about how it will fly around the moon there.
Sure. Yeah. So this is it's a flyby mission because if we were to orbit Europa, the radiation environment is just too punishing. So we're actually orbiting Jupiter and doing multiple very close flybys of Europa. The closest one is about 15 miles from the surface. And at that point, we'll be traveling something like 10,000 miles per hour, just screaming across the surface. These flybys, there's about 50 of them in the nominal mission. And at each one, we'll have all of the instruments trained on Europa's surface gathering data at the same time.
Mm-hmm. What would make this mission successful to you? How would you both judge that? Yes, this has all been a success.
That's a great question. I very much expect that we are going to have so many new questions. And that, I think, in itself will be the success. I think being able to have these beautiful high resolution images, when you think about what images we were able to take in the 90s versus what we can take now with a camera, and understanding that geology, understanding the composition, really getting to some of those big questions about what kind of salt is in the ocean. You know, are there these active plumes? Are there regions of the ice that are maybe thinner than other parts, so that if there is the potential for habitability, you know, where should we go land and what should we do next with this moon? Mm-hmm. I think if we're able to get to any of those types of questions, that would really truly define a successful mission.
Yeah, I agree with Dr. Becker. Of course, we do have formal requirements that that NASA headquarters expects us to achieve. So that will be kind of the formal measure of success for the mission. But I think in terms of the science, yeah, it's just going to be exciting no matter what. And we're going to be able to answer a lot of questions, but we're also going to have a lot of new questions. And for scientists, that's hugely exciting.
That usually is. And this is a really big spacecraft, isn't it?
It's huge. Europa Clipper from wing to wing is about 100 feet across. It's the biggest spacecraft that NASA has built for a planetary mission. And part of that is because we need enormous solar panels to power the spacecraft out at Jupiter. There's not a lot of light out there.
No. It's about the size of a basketball court when the solar panels are extended.
Yeah. And so then it's done its laps around the moon. It's taken all the pictures and collected all the data that you want. What happens to the Clipper after that?
Well, then we actually are going to crash it. And that's because one of our biggest concerns is the potential of bringing any kind of microbes from Earth that may survive the intense journey and even the experience in Jupiter's radiation. We would never want to introduce any of those microbes to Europa accidentally. So we don't want to have the possibility of Clipper just hanging out in the Jupiter system and one day crashing into Europa. Because if there is life there, or the potential for life, we could ultimately destroy that with our own microbes. So we will crash the spacecraft, and the current plan is to crash it into one of Jupiter's other moons, but there is also the option for crashing it directly into Jupiter. So we will dispose of the spacecraft, hopefully not just after the prime mission. If we're still doing great science and all the instrumentation are working, we could still continue the mission for a few more years. But once we do sort of see that the mission is over, we will dispose of the spacecraft.
That's got to be kind of bittersweet for scientists who, right? You've been around this spacecraft so long and worked with it and all the mission possibilities.
Yeah, I was there for the end of the Cassini spacecraft mission at JPL, where all the scientists and engineers who had worked on this mission for many decades gathered to watch the last signals of Cassini come through before Cassini crashed into Saturn. For similar reasons, you know, Cassini, we didn't want to contaminate any other of the moons there either. And so it was very bittersweet to see that last blip of a signal data come down and then that just be it after so many decades of planning the mission, building the mission, and of course, doing all the amazing science that we did with that mission.
I study impact craters, so I'm going to have really mixed feelings because we're also going to create a new impact crater on one of Jupiter's other moons. And that itself is a really interesting scientific experiment.
Sort of a geeky sort of thing. I want to see. All right. One last question before we go. I want to hear your absolute favorite Europa fact. Tracy, you want to begin? Fun fact about Europa.
Let me think about that for a second.
Only one?
So my favorite fact about Europa is actually that Europa, we know that it's mostly water ice. We know that from looking at it in the visible and looking at it at infrared wavelengths. But in the wavelength regime that I like to use to study Europa, which is in the ultraviolet, it does not look like water. And we don't know why. And so that's one of the things I'm looking forward to most is studying Europa with a UV instrument and to understand why doesn't it look like water at UV wavelengths.
Wow, that is something weird. Wow. Ingrid?
I think probably my favorite fact is about just how few impact craters there are on the surface. You know, we're used to looking at other bodies, even in the same system. Jupiter's other moons are, they've been bombarded for billions of years with asteroids and comets, and there's craters all over them. But Europa has very few. Those that are there are very interesting and they're very weird shaped. So we look forward to studying those to understand it more. But the lack of craters is actually really interesting too, because it shows just how young this moon's surface is. So there are active processes. They have to be going on right now. And can't wait to find out what those are.
How young is young?
We think it's maybe somewhere around 90 million years. It's pretty young, compared to other surfaces.
Wow. I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. And it's a three, right? It's going to take a few years before it gets there.
About 6 years of cruise. Yeah.
We arrive in April of 2030.
Wow. Six. You think you can wait that long?
We don't have much choice.
Well, thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Dr. Ingrid Daubar, associate professor at Brown University and a Europa Clipper project staff scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. And Dr. Tracy Becker, planetary scientist at Southwest Research Institute and co-investigator on the Europa Clipper mission. After the break, death, or at least the perception of it in the animal kingdom. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Kathleen Davis. Throughout history, humans have given a lot of thought to death. We grapple with the inevitability of mortality. We create elaborate burial rituals, and we decide how best to mourn the loss of a loved one. But what about other animals? How do they understand death? Joining me now to help answer that question and more is my guest, Dr. Susanna Monceau, author of Playing Possum, How Animals Understand Death. She's also Associate Professor of Philosophy at the National Distance Education University in Madrid, Spain. Dr. Monceau, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I want to jump right in and talk about the animal that's in the title of your book, which is a possum, or as they're sometimes called, opossums. What's so special about possums and their relationship with death?
Yeah, so the opossum is an animal that I find really fascinating, apart from the fact that they're super cute, in my opinion. The opossum, when she feels threatened and she feels like she cannot escape, she pretends that she's dead. But she does this in an extremely elaborate way. So she adopts the bodily and facial expression of a corpse. Her body temperature drops. Her breathing and heart rate are reduced. She expels this putrid-smelling liquid from her glands, and she stops responding to the world. She also opens her mouth, and her tongue hangs out, and it adopts this like bluish hue. So it's a very, very elaborate ritual. If you don't know ahead of time that she engages in this little trick, you would be fooled by her for sure. And the opossum is in the title of my book because I think the opossum gives us some clues for how animals understand death. And this is not because the opossum herself understands that she's playing dead. I think that for the opossum, this is probably an automatic reaction, like when our pupils dilate or our hair stands on end when we're afraid. Her display tells us something about how the predators that she's trying to deceive understand death. So in order to understand this, I think it's helpful to think about the peacock's tail. So the peacock has this beautiful, gorgeous, enormous tail that is like very problematic to have in a lot of regards because it makes it more difficult to fly and to run away from predators. However, they have this tail because the peahens love it, right? And so the tail tells us something about the peahen's mind. It tells us what she finds sexy. And something similar can be said of the opossum's death display. It's not that it's telling us something about the opossum's mind, but rather it's telling us something about how her predators understand death. It shows us that they think of dead individuals as having a certain facial expression and bodily posture, as being cold, as showing no signs of breathing, smelling bad, not responding to the world, etc. So the opossum's display gives us a window into the minds of her predators. It shows us how they understand death.
Mm-hmm. So in your book, you write a lot about this thing called the minimal concept of death. Tell me a little bit about what you mean by that and why it's important to define when we're talking about animals' understanding of death.
The question of whether animals understand death is one that requires us to first define what exactly we mean by understanding death. And more often than not, this notion, the concept of death, has been understood in very demanding ways. The question has been construed as, do animals have a concept of death that is equivalent to the human adult's average concept of death? So one that entails, you know, an understanding of the concept of absence, of infinity, of, you know, abstract thinking. I think that understanding this question this way, on the one hand, is a little bit unfair because that's not usually how we pose the question when we think about human children. Like, human children don't acquire a concept of death overnight. Rather, it's something that takes them a while to develop. It takes them several years before they fully understand death. Like, if you've ever played Super Mario Brothers with a six-year-old, you will know that they do grasp something about death, right? So we're kind of setting a double standard if we're if we're asking the question in different terms when thinking about children and thinking about animals. But also I think that construing the question this way just makes it a not very interesting question. You know, if what we mean when we ask if animals can understand death is whether they have anything equivalent to the human adult average concept of death, the answer is going to be no. And, you know, that would have made for a very short book. So it's more interesting, I think, to ask, do animals have anything that counts as a concept of death? And for that, what I do is I begin from what I call the minimal concept of death. So like the bare minimum that an animal would need to understand in order to be credited with some understanding of death. And the minimal concept of death basically just amounts to the idea that dead individuals don't do the sorts of things that living beings do, and that this is an irreversible state. So that once you're in this state, you cannot go back to being alive. And so the idea is we start from there, and then we can look into how complex animals' concept of death actually is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's start with some of the smallest examples of creatures in your book. I was really fascinated to read about ants. So ants will try to save a fellow ant who is trapped, and they'll remove dead ants from their nests. But you also say that they don't actually seem to understand death. So explain to me what this means.
In the case of ants, exemplifies what I call stereotypical reactions to death. So these are reactions to death that are kind of pre-programmed, so to speak. So the animal doesn't need to learn them or acquire them, but rather evolution has sort of programmed them into the animal's behavioral repertoire. So these reactions are triggered whenever the animal senses certain stimuli in her environment. So for instance, when it comes to ants taking out of the nest their dead nestmates, this is something that presupposes their capacity to tell live ants apart from dead ones. But we know that there's no concept of death involved because this behavior of theirs is very dependent on the presence of certain cues in the environment, such as certain chemical elements given off by decomposing corpses. An example of this is oleic acid. So if you take some oleic acid and you put it on a piece of leaf or a little pebble or even a live ant, the ants are going to treat it like a dead ant, and they're going to pick it up and take it out of the colony. So this shows us that they're not really understanding what being dead means. They're just reacting in a way that they can't really help to certain cues in their environment.
That's fascinating. So let's pivot to talk about our closest relatives, which are primates. What do we know about their understanding of death?
So I have to say that the research here is still, you know, very young, and we're still only just starting to ask these questions. So we don't have any real certainty here about how exactly they understand death. However, we do have certain important pieces of evidence. For instance, in the case of chimpanzees, what we see is that there is huge variability in how they react to death. So for instance, there was a very famous case that came out about 10 years ago where an adolescent male had died, and the scientists documented the reactions of the remaining group members to the corpse of this individual. And what they found was huge variability in the reactions. So some of them sat around the corpse and looked at it or inspected it in different ways, by touching it or sniffing it. Others reacted aggressively, hitting the corpse or engaging in dominance displays. And there was also one female who stayed behind once the rest of the group had left and started to clean the teeth of the corpse. So this doesn't tell us necessarily that they understand death, but it does tell us that it's something very different from the case of the ants, because what we're seeing here is what I call cognitive reactions to death. So these are reactions that involve the psychology of the individual, her emotions, her personality, her life history, her beliefs, her desires, and so on. And that's why we can't predict in advance how they're going to react. Apart from that, we see in a lot of primates, we see a lot of interest towards corpses. We see a lot of what looks like grief, you know, so a lot of clues that suggest that they may have an understanding of death.
Mm-hmm. So since chimps are so closely related to us, could they be having similar responses to death as we do, as humans do?
So in the literature, very often scientists have argued that what we see in chimpanzees are behavioral reactions that are analogous to a lot of the human behavioral reactions to death. However, I think this is a little bit of a dangerous road to go down. We have to be wary of what I call emotional anthropocentrism. Mm-hmm. So the idea that the only emotional reactions to death that are worthy of our attention are human-like reactions. Because, you know, some of the reactions to death that we see in other animals are very difficult to make sense of from a human perspective, at least from the perspective of, you know, Western contemporary societies. So we often see reactions like cannibalism or necrophilia that, you know, would be very problematic mm-hmm. to see in our societies. And so this may lead us to, you know, somehow conclude from that they don't understand death because they don't respect corpses the way that we do. But that, for me, doesn't really follow, you know, because There's one question, which is, can you understand what death means? Can you understand the finality of it? Can you understand that dead individuals cannot come back to life? And a different question is, do you react to death the way a human would mm-hmm. react? For instance, do you react with grief? Grief for us is like the paradigmatic emotional reaction right. to death. But it doesn't necessarily follow from understanding that someone has died that you're going to grieve them, right? So for instance, when Amy Winehouse died, I could understand that she wouldn't be producing any more music. But I didn't necessarily grieve her, even though, of course, I was sad as an Amy Winehouse fan. I was sad that she died. But I didn't grieve her because I didn't have the sorts of emotional bond that you need to have towards an individual in order to really be set to grieve their loss.
Right. I have certainly seen videos on the internet, for example, or have heard stories where people definitely put that emotion of grief onto animals, whether it's deserved or not, right? Like, for example, I've certainly seen videos of elephants that seem to be having like a deeply emotional response to a dead elephant in their group. Or there are people who will have two pets who grow up together and then one of them dies. And then the other one seems to be really melancholy and actually be quite sad. But is there any sort of scientific proof that these animals are experiencing grief?
I mean, the word proof is a very strong word, and it's very rare that in science we get proof of things. But it's certainly a well-supported hypothesis. We do have a lot of evidence that animals grieve. Anthropologist Barbara King, for instance, wrote this beautiful book called How Animals Grieve that has, you know, a lot of stories of animals grieving. And I think it's a super important topic, and it's definitely something that we need to pay attention to, especially because it has very important ethical implications. If animals do grieve, it has implications for, you know, our treatment of them. However, the problem is that if we're only focusing on grief, then we're potentially missing out on many other dimensions of animals' relationship with mortality. You know, a very important dimension, for instance, is the one of violence. Very often, death in the natural world is something that animals cause on purpose, mm-hmm. you know, and very often, death for animals is not a loss, but a gain. And, you know, if we're only talking about grief, then we're only talking about context where death is a loss, which, you know, is going to be something that happens very often. And it's a very important question, but it's not the full picture, because very often death is going to be a gain.
Mm-hmm. So for a long time, scientists and philosophers didn't think that animals could possibly understand death, or conversely, that it wasn't worth studying. So what has changed?
Well, I still think that a lot of philosophers think that and a lot of scientists think that. So I'm not so sure that that much has changed. But it's certainly starting to garner attention. I think one of the reasons why scientists are starting to ask this question has to do with the cognitivist revolution. So this is something that started to happen in psychology in the 80s, where there was this reaction against behaviorism, you know, this like dogma that we shouldn't be discussing the minds of animals and we should just be describing their behavior. So once, you know, scientists got rid of behaviorism, or they left it behind, they started to ask questions about the minds of animals, and they started to ask questions about the capacities that animals have. But still, there's a lot of fear of falling into anthropomorphism and attributing human-like qualities to animals in an unwarranted way. But at the same time, the evidence has just started accumulating, you know, and there have been more and more cases that biologists in the field have just happened to stumble upon. And at a certain point, the number of cases became so big that, you know, they could no longer ignore it. And so this new discipline, comparative thanatology, was born about, you know, a decade ago. And it's starting to gain a lot of traction as more and more people have started sharing the data that they've gathered.
Well, there is clearly so much to talk about here, but unfortunately, we've run out of time. But I'd love to thank my guest, Dr. Susanna Monceau, author of Playing Possum, How Animals Understand Death. Dr. Monceau, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
One last thing before we go. Did you know that Science Friday has a book club? Every month, we choose a fascinating science book, including classics and new releases, to read together. Next month's book is A Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold, a collection of essays from the 1930s and 40s about wildlife, natural history, and Leopold's now infamous concept of land ethics. Consider joining our online community of book lovers and science nerds at sciencefriday.com/bookclub. And that's it for this hour. A lot of folks helped make the show happen this week, including
Sandy Roberts,
Robin Kasmer,
Jordan Smudgick,
Charles Bergquist,
George Harper.
Thanks, everybody. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. I'm Kathleen Davis. Have a great weekend. This is Science Friday. I'm Kathleen Davis. Here at SciFry, we're big fans of metaphors. They can help make complicated science concepts easier to understand, both for the public and for scientists themselves. Take, for example, the Big Bang. That helps us visualize the beginning of the universe. Or we can understand amino acids as the building blocks of proteins. But as our next guests have shown, these scientific metaphors can also have a dark side, and they can even set research back. Sam Harnett and Chris Hoff are the hosts of the podcast series The World According to Sound, and they're here to tell us about their new project, An Inexact Science. It's a special 2-hour episode that explores how language and metaphor have shaped science, for better or for worse. Here's SciFry's John Dankosky.
Sam Harnett and Chris Hoff, welcome back to Science Friday. Good to have you guys here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, nice to be here.
Okay, so first of all, why did you want to do a series about language in science history? I mean, what gave you this idea?
Yeah, I think it's what appealed to me is that a metaphor seems on its surface like the most unscientific thing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, when you hear metaphor, you think about poetry, and it's by nature kind of an imprecise way of expressing things. But when you look back at the history of science, metaphors are integral to some of the biggest discoveries, to even doing basic science. And I think in a bigger sense, metaphor is a window into how social and cultural forces shape science. Everything from what we think science is to how it should be done to who can do science is shaped by social and cultural forces. And that's really evident when you start looking at the metaphors we use in science.
It's interesting, too, because I think especially around election years, we think about metaphor in the context of trying to sway people's opinion and something that's used in politics an awful lot. But I think in science, you've got to sell your ideas, too. And I think metaphors kind of come in handy there.
Right. But the more that we looked at the history of science, the more that you see that metaphor is essential to the theories themselves. I think evolution is a great example. I thought of Darwin really as this like this, you know, hyper-rational scientist who gathered all this data and then came up with this theory. But in reality, he didn't have enough data to conclusively prove his ideas. So what he had to do is to craft a story. And so he had all of these data points, and then he crafted a story, and he used metaphor to craft that story. And he labored over which metaphors to use. If you look at his journals, you know, they change many times. And things like natural selection or the tree of life or the tangled bank, I mean, these are essential to the theory itself.
Yeah, and I also just would add that, like, the sheer complexity of so much that's going on in science, like if you look at, say, a black hole, unless you're a super advanced mathematician, there's really no way to make sense of a thing like that. And so you have to use this kind of language that does make sense to our everyday lives. And that's what a metaphor is. It's just a way to take this really complex idea or phenomenon and put it in language that makes sense to us.
Okay, so I'd like to get to one of the words that you look at. It's the word cell. Okay, so some of us might remember from middle school biology that there's a 17th century scientist named Robert Hooke, and he gave us the name cell, and it was inspired, I guess, by the rooms of a monastery, the place where monks lived,
right,
which were also called cells. But there's like more to this story here, right?
Yeah, the cell one is really interesting because it's the first person to sort of observe them under a microscope, this guy Robert Hooke, and they just structurally looked like a room with four walls, like this four-walled thing. And so he said, okay, I'll just call that a cell. Of course, over time, we find out more and more, and people keep building off this idea. Like this guy after him, Franz Unger, he starts calling them building blocks. But like all these words, they're really inaccurate. Like a cell is not at all like a room. It doesn't function at all like a building block. Like these things are fluid, like things can move in and out of them. Like it's just actually totally wrong. Like the metaphor is wrong. And that's a really good example of sort of a metaphor actually kind of blocking advancement, blocking progress, because we're thinking about them in this term that it just is not at all. And so that's like it's a good example of an inaccurate metaphor actually hindering scientific progress.
I'd also add that there's this whole history of personifying the cell, which again comes from this idea of it as an individual unit. Eventually, cells got to be thought of kind of as like miniature organisms. And they got sort of ascribed personality as if they were actually the same as an animal. And in a similar way, kind of block the idea that, that they functioned together and collectively.
I think one of the things that I'm so fascinated by is the idea that the metaphor turns out to be completely wrong. It's not a cell at all, but yet the word persists for hundreds of years. We're probably always going to be talking about cells. So why is it so persistent despite its inaccuracy?
I think it's two things. One, I think it's a good cautionary tale. A lot of these metaphors, they can be misleading in terms of research, but they could also have social and cultural biases that have a big effect on what people study and why. But the second thing I'd add is also, it points to the importance of just interrogating the metaphors all the time. I mean, you can't do science without metaphors. As Chris was saying, you can't really, you know, conceive of a black hole without a metaphor. We need them. And so the story of Cell is an indicator that we should constantly be thinking about these metaphors. Are they apt? Are they not accurate anymore? Do they have biases in them?
You actually tell a different story about brain cells called glia. Let's take a listen.
Once glia were recognized as important agents in the nervous system, the metaphor shifted again to masculine ones.
Construction supervisors, architects, board members, creators and defenders, brain wardens. Lord of central nervous system development, one cell to rule them all.
I like one cell to rule them all. So tell us more of that story.
Sure. So this is based on a wonderful essay by two academics, Meg Upchurch and Simona Fitova. And what they do is they trace the evolution of different metaphors used to describe glia. And glia are cells in the brain like neurons. And at the start, glia were thought of to be nothing more than sort of packing material. And so the first metaphors were, you know, packing material or waste or sponge-like cells. But then they realized, oh, these glia are actually kind of doing something. They seem to be helping the neurons. And the neurons were cast as like the stars of the show. And so the neurons got the male metaphors. You know, they were the actors and the stars. And the glia then were given more female-coded metaphors. You know, they were thought of as nursing the neurons or cleaning up after them. They were cleaning the house, right?
Caregivers.
Yeah, caregivers. And then as they found out more, they realized, actually, these glia are really important, and actually, they're really diverse. And at that moment, that's when the metaphors shifted back to male metaphors. And as you just heard, they sort of then got these masculine metaphors. So in this story, you hear like inherent sexism, but then also a lot of these metaphors that we use at certain periods of time, again, kind of they dismiss the glia, and researchers who were sort of disincentivized from working on this unglamorous, you know, caregiver or attendant cell as opposed to the star of the show, the neuron.
Chris, I guess I'm wondering if there are some examples of some metaphor that you have learned that really had positive outcomes for science, where the metaphor itself really, really helped us understand something a bit better.
Yeah, that's a good question. I have a good sort of negative example of that, but you can kind of flip it and see where the positive would be. I think that we did a short little story about how we often talk about diseases, and specifically cancer or AIDS or something that's really kind of horrendous and bad. And the metaphors we almost always use around that are like basically war and fighting metaphors, right? Like we are battling cancer. I lost my battle with cancer. We have to fight COVID. You know, we're on the front lines on the battle against HIV. But there's no logical reason why we have to talk about them that way. And in fact, if you talked about them in a totally different way, there's a lot of actually science that gets that you get more positive results. So if you talked about it, it's more of like, oh, I'm cohabitating with cancer, or I'm living with this thing. Like in the end, you know, my body produced this thing, so why should I be sort of rebelling against it? I should just be living with it. And so you could see, if you actually change your viewpoint on the metaphors that you use, there's actual results where people are getting just better outcomes as a result.
Now I would add, you know, there's a story of evolution, which I think evolution would not exist without the metaphors it's based on. I mean, that's a big part of Darwin's work. But one metaphor that we came across that I really liked was the metaphor of quilting. Mm-hmm. And there's a professor who used quilting as a metaphor to describe the process of science, of doing science, was like stitching together a quilt. And she wrote this essay about quilting as a metaphor, as a counterpoint to a lot of the aggressive masculine metaphors that dominate the way we think about science. You know, science is about discovery and conquering and a lot of things that are coded as masculine. And she wrote this beautiful essay just recasting all of science as quilting. And it shows the power, again, of if you change the metaphor, it sort of changes the whole nature of how you understand something. Suddenly science is collaborative, it's painstaking, it's this act of like putting together all these different scraps of fabric into something new. It's not this like individually led conquest. So the idea that one little work has sort of changed the whole way we think about things, and this is not to do science, but it's how we think about science.
I guess at the end of all this, did you come away with a couple of, I don't know, best practices? Because there's a lot of people who are involved in science and the sciences who listen to this program and probably are listening to this thinking, you know, there might be a better way to use language in the work that I do that could, I don't know, help people understand it, help me sell what I'm trying to do. What are some takeaways that maybe you have for the scientific community from what you learned?
Yeah, I think the first major one would just be to really interrogate every sort of word choice that you're using, especially when you're communicating your work. You know, if you're talking about disease again, and you're using battling and war metaphors, like you could just think about that and think about the effect that it could have on the reader. And just think about also how it's influencing your own thought about your own work.
And I would add that, you know, there is this perception that science is somehow hyper-rational and objective in a way that's very distant from other work in academia, that's distant from the humanities and social science. And if you look at the history of science, there's actually a lot of overlap. It's more of a thing to embrace, you know, to think about the ways in which science is not totally precise and objective and rational. And in thinking about that, you will A, recognize times when you make mistakes, but B, I think there's more things to investigate when you think that way.
And it's something we've covered in the past in the program, but maybe it's not such a bad idea for scientists to, I don't know, take a poetry course now and again.
Right. Exactly.
Sam Harnett, Chris Hoff, they're co-producers of the podcast, The World According to Sound. Sam and Chris, as always, great to talk to you guys. Thanks so much for bringing us these stories.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, we know the body changes a lot during pregnancy, but new research shows just how much changes in the brain. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Kathleen Davis. Pregnancy is a hugely transformative experience, both in life and in the body. But there's a key part of the body that's been pretty under-researched in relation to pregnancy, and that's the brain. If you've been pregnant, you may have noticed differences in your own brain. Last month, a study in the journal Nature Neuroscience outlined transformative changes that happen in the brain during pregnancy. And here with me to explain these changes and what they might mean is my guest, Dr. Liz Krastel, Associate Professor of Neurobiology and Behavior at the University of California, Irvine. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
So this research, it's my understanding, is very near and dear to your heart because it wasn't just any pregnant brain that was being studied. It was yours, right?
Right. I was studying my own brain. So I was working with Emily Jacobs, my collaborator, and her student, Laura Pritchard, who had just finished a menstrual cycle study. And we were working on menopause in other ways. But then I was planning a pregnancy. And so we said, hey, we got to do this. So that's how it sort of started. And we went from there. And it was, really exciting to be your own participant in your own study.
And it sounds like this is a really understudied part of pregnancy research, right? Studying the actual brain.
Exactly. We had almost no information about the human brain and what happens during pregnancy. There had been a few studies looking before and after, testing people before they got pregnant and then what their brains look like after pregnancy. But we were really missing the during. And so we had really almost no idea what was going to happen to the human brain while pregnancy was ongoing.
And so what were you really hoping to pinpoint here?
We're hoping to look at understanding more about what was happening, again, during pregnancy. We were looking at a couple of key features. So we were looking at brain structures, mainly focusing on the structure of the brain and how it might change. So we're looking at volume, like sizes, and like the strength of the connections and the quality of the brain connections. So we're looking at gray matter, which is the cell bodies of the neurons, and we're looking at volume of gray matter in certain areas like the hippocampus, which is important for learning and memory. And it's important for when people have something like brain fog, that might be part of it. So we're looking there. We're looking at cortical thickness, which again is sort of volume across the brain. And then we were looking at white matter, which are the axons of the neurons, which are the connections between neurons. And those are sort of these big fiber tracks that go across the brain. And we're looking at the health of those connectivity and sort of how well the connections are. And so we think of white matter as like a road, and you want your road to be well paved. So we were looking at the quality of those connections there.
And so as kind of the central test subject in this project, what sort of tests did you actually run yourself through to find out the answers to these things?
So we did MRI scanning. And so the scans did several structural scans looking at those volumes that I was talking about, diffusion imaging, which looks at the white matter. We have a couple other ones that we did as well. It was about, a half hour scan, 45 minutes each time, and just went in there and did a blood draw as well so that we could also connect it with sex hormones.
Mm-hmm. What is it like to be at the center of a study that you're actually doing research on? Was that a little bit of like a no pun intended, was that a little bit of like a cognitive challenge for you?
It was okay. It was exciting, I think, more than anything, because again, we were just forging new territory. And so it was sort of like, we needed a neuroscientist to do this study almost, because knowing what it takes to do these MRI scans. Of course, I've done tons of MRI scans in the past just because that's what my research is about. And so sort of being able to know what it takes to do this and what it might be involved with was part of it. And so it was just more exciting than anything. And we never really looked at the data until it was done. And so that was another thing that was helpful, I think, because I didn't see my brain changing in real time at any time. Mm. So, we never wanted to affect anything with the study while it was going on. And so we didn't look at it until well after. So I just kind of was going in and hoping everything was fine, but not looking at how things were changing.
Right. I would imagine if you're actually looking at scans in real time and seeing, oh, wow, things are really changing in there, that might be a little disorienting.
Right. Exactly. And, we had expected for sure some changes. And again, looking at the pre and post studies, we had expected some decreases in gray matter volume. So it wouldn't be totally surprising, but we still didn't want to do it in the time.
So tell me exactly what you found.
So we found overall this decrease in gray matter volume and cortical thickness across the board of about 4%, which is not that big, but that's a sizable amount when you're thinking about your brain. And there was some variability. So some actually increased a little bit. Some went down by as much as like 13%. But overall, the average was about 4% brain reduction in volume from before and after. And that was pretty much a linear trend. So it kind of kept going down. We did also some postpartum scans, so several scans after pregnancy, and then about 6 months and a year and 2 years out. And so that gray matter volume rebounded a little bit, but it mostly stayed the same, and then it kind of kept the same level for the 2 years out. Then we also found in the white matter this really interesting nonlinear relationship. So what we found was an increase in the white matter connectivity integrity that peaked around the second to third trimester. And then it went back to baseline by the time the baby was born. And so that had this sort of interesting peak and then return of sort of integrity that we wouldn't have seen if we had just done a before and after design. So if we had just done before and after, we would have completely missed that part. And so this was a really new and interesting finding that we were able to discover.
In general, what do we know about gray matter, white matter, and what they actually do in the brain, like what their purpose is?
Yeah. So, you know, gray matter are the cell bodies. And so, you know, we think that a reduction in gray matter might be worse, right? So sort of when you think about it, you're like, oh, your brain shrinks. That doesn't sound so great. But, you know, there's a lot of things that are going on there. So there are pruning. So, and it could be the amount of dendritic spines, which are the connections between sort of each neuron at the synapse. And so that's one possibility in terms of the reduction. And that might not be a bad thing. So in adolescence, there's a similar reduction in volume during the adolescence and puberty time. And so it's not necessarily a problem. We also see this during childhood, that there can be changes in connectivity and pruning and things like that. So reductions in volume are not necessarily a bad thing. But we don't necessarily know, again, what the actual cellular mechanisms are for this reduction in volume. And likewise, we don't necessarily know what the cellular mechanisms are for the increase in white matter integrity. We'd need some more animal studies to do that. But what we can say is, again, that we do see this, the quality of the connection. So the white matter is again, like this sort of like tube that runs across your brain, connecting broad areas, or straw. Sometimes we think about that. So we're looking at the diffusion of water in the white matter. And so it looks like the diffusion is happening, or it's less diffusion in the sense that it's going more like it's going through a straw, which is what you want. You want it to be more like it's going through the straw and sort of better road paving, again, for your white matter. So you know, these are how your neurons are connecting to each other and how their volume is happening. And so, again, what we need to know now that we have some of this information is to go into either in vitro studies or animal studies and to understand more about what are those particular dynamics happening on the cellular level. So we're looking at a scale that's a little harder for us to see at this point.
I know that you study behavior. At this point, is there anything we can glean about how these differences in gray matter and white matter might actually change our behavior in pregnancy?
That's the big question that we want to find out. So we know a little bit about behavior. So we know from animals that if you give animals who have never had any pups, if you give them some of these hormones, that they will now have some changes in their maternal behavior and grooming behavior and caregiving behavior and things like that. So we know that there are some certainly aspects of this. We know from another study, from that Susanna Caramona study that looked at before and after in humans, that some of the relationship with the volume reduction that they saw was related to some social interactions, recognizing your infants, and so a little bit of maternal care. So we think that there's some relationship, but we still don't really know what it means. And so that's the big question that we want to move forward with, is understanding, does it mean anything for care? Does it mean anything for things like brain fog or thinking or anything like that? So I didn't actually experience any brain fog when I was pregnant. So, as far as I remember, so I didn't really have that experience, but a lot of people do. And so we want to know more about what's going to likely happen in terms of these changes in the brain, and are they going to be affecting people's behavior?
Yeah, I want to ask you about brain fog, because I've heard this term pregnancy brain referred to a lot by people in my life over the years. And, you know, this idea that there is brain fog and maybe forgetfulness that happens during and after pregnancy. We even got a message from listener Chris in Traverse City, who said that they could feel their IQ drop when they were pregnant. I think there's maybe a little bit of a joke in there, but could this idea of pregnancy brain be connected to these changes? And like, what do we need to study to know if that's the truth?
Right. So it's certainly possible. And so that's, again, what we need to find out. And so there's a lot of things that can contribute to pregnancy brain, this feeling, right? So what we don't know exactly is where it's stemming from. So, you know, you're not sleeping as much or sleeping as well, certainly during pregnancy, but of course, well after pregnancy, right? You're stressed out, you're worried, lots of things like that. You're starting to like take care of another, you know, human being. You have to manage all these other things, right? So there's a lot of things that can be going on both during and after pregnancy that we can attribute this to. And so it's hard to know exactly if it's specific to the brain structure, if it's more about sleep, if it's more about stress or other things. And so that's what we need to find out more with. So one thing that we're really interested in looking at next is some of these behaviors and thinking about both cognition in terms of pregnancy brain and thinking. We're also really interested in thinking about postpartum depression and peripartum depression. So a lot of people, again, experience these depressive symptoms, and we want to know if the structure is important for that. And so is it anything that's happening during pregnancy? Is that predictive of postpartum depression? Is it after pregnancy? Is it something else? And so understanding more about that is going to be really informative. There's lots of other things that might be important too, things like preeclampsia, which is really more like high blood pressure, but that's a vascular issue that's going to affect your brain. And there might be signatures of preeclampsia in the brain, and that might also have long-term health implications. And so that's something, again, that can be really important as we move forward. So I think there's a lot of open questions here. And this research, I think, really opens more questions than it answers. And so that's why we're excited about it.
It makes me wonder if these changes in the brain during pregnancy is one of those things that developed in evolution and it has some sort of importance, but we just might not know what it is yet.
Exactly. And so that's sort of my take on it, is that, you know, we've had millions of years of evolution, and this is probably adaptive in some way, but we don't necessarily know what way that is adaptive, right? So it's almost certainly going to be helpful. But is it a trade-off with other things, right? So because your body's changing with all these other systems that are going on, and there's certain energy requirements, right? So is it going to be a trade-off with other things? Or is it enhancing, right? Again, likely to be in maternal care or other things, but maybe not. And so figuring out where it's adaptive and then where it's maladaptive, right? So when it goes wrong and someone gets postpartum depression or something else, right? Where is that happening? And how can we detect that and sort of figure out ways to detect and treat that?
Mm-hmm. So to me, it's a little staggering that this type of research hasn't been done before, considering how many pregnancies happen all the time. When you got pregnant, were you like, okay, if no one else is going to do this work, I'm just going to do it on myself, on my own terms?
Yeah, pretty much. Exactly. So we kind of knew that you needed a neuroscientist to do this. And so, you know, I've done MRI scans many times in my life, just because that's what we do. And so, you know, being able to know what it takes to do this and to set this up and to make it happen was kind of needed. And yeah, it really is just shocking. I mean, the paper, again, it opens more questions than it answers. And so it's just the fact that we ask this question is why we're getting so much response, because people want to know and no one's bothered to find out. And so that's where I think there's a lot of open things to talk about. And it's really, again, shocking. It's 2024 and we know so little about what goes on during pregnancy and generally in the female brain and other things. So like, again, thinking about menopause, that's another area that we're really interested in. And again, very little is known about that. I think there's a little bit more there, but you know, historically, women's brain health has been understudied, and so that's something that really needs to have a change in understanding and approach to think about that.
Did actually having this pregnancy experience bring up other questions that you want to know the answer to? You know, being pregnant while working on this study. I mean, are there other things that came up that maybe you weren't expecting to?
Yeah, well, I think for sure, you know, certainly I didn't necessarily know what to expect, what sorts of things would happen. And so, yeah, so I wasn't sure whether I would have any, you know, sort of brain fog symptoms, and I didn't, but I could have, and that might have had certain implications. Just trying to understand more about, you know, comfort levels and things like that, trying to understand more about, yeah, just sort of planning and stress, all the stress and things like that were definitely something that I would like to be able to do more. And then sort of support systems, I think, as well afterwards. I think that's a big important question that should be studied more, and we didn't get a chance to look at that.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked a lot about the unknowns that still exist around this topic. But now that we have this first round of information, we have this map, right? I mean, what would you really love to learn next?
Would really love to learn how this relates to your brain function. And so again, this was all structure. And so understanding more about this, the functioning of your brain would be a really important question. And then how that relates more to behavior. So again, and behavior very broadly. So again, memory, attention, depression, all those sorts of things. I think they're all open.
Well, that is all the time that we have for now. I would love to thank my guest, Dr. Liz Krastel, Associate Professor of Neurobiology and Behavior at the University of California, Irvine. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
And one more thing before we head to the break. We need you for just a couple of minutes. Yes, you. We're surveying listeners to our radio show and our podcast, the folks who attend live or virtual events, those of you who follow us on social media, who are dedicated to our book club. We want to hear from all of you, no matter how you enjoy Science Friday. So go to sciencefriday.com/survey. This is your chance to help write the next chapter of Science Friday. So we want to hear from as many of you as possible. Once again, that's sciencefriday.com/survey. And thanks. After the break, how a grain called kernza is making its way into food and drinks. We'll talk about what this grain is and its benefits for the soil.
When we're looking for crops that both feed people but also help mitigate some of the effects of people on the planet, something like this long-lived relative of wheat is really appealing. And I'll just mention this is one of thousands of species.
Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Kathleen Davis. And now it's time to check in on the state of science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
Iowa Public Radio News.
Local science stories of national significance. Corn and soybeans are two of the most produced crops in the United States. They're grown on more than 170 million acres of farmland. But these crops need to be replanted each year, which can cause problems with the soil. Some plant scientists are serving up an alternative, a grain called kernza, which can live in the ground for several years. Here with more is my guest, Eric Schmid, economic development reporter at St. Louis Public Radio in Missouri. Eric, welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, Eric, what is kernza?
So kernza is the grain that comes from intermediate wheatgrass. So intermediate wheatgrass is the plant, and kernza is those little tiny kernels that would be harvested to make flour or to go into beer or any other types of products.
Okay, so what are some of the advantages of growing kernza over some other grains that we might be more familiar with?
Many of the crops that we have growing in our land today are planted every year. They're these things called annual crops. Kernza is a perennial crop. It stays in the ground every single year, so it doesn't have to be replanted. This means that it can grow really deep roots, persistent roots that hold the soil in place. They make new soil. They can absorb water, take up extra nutrients, sequester carbon, even host a really diverse microbiome. I spoke with Allison Miller, who's a plant scientist at the Donald Danforth Plant Science Research Center, and she's somebody who studies kernza for its applications into the future.
When we're looking for crops that both feed people but also help mitigate some of the effects of people on the planet, something like this long-lived relative of wheat is really appealing.
The real question is, what does it taste like?
In the beer that I tried for this story, it just tasted really good. And actually, I think the head brewer who made that, Jason Thompson at Blue Jay Brewing, says it better than me.
It's got a little bit different mouthfeel, I think, than barley beers, for sure. And definitely earthy, almost nutty.
And that's the same that I found when I baked with it. I baked a challah bread with half kerns of flour and half white flour. And it just tasted really good. I don't know how else to describe it than just a little bit more full-bodied and you know, kind of sweet and nutty.
How common is kernza at the moment?
Yeah, it's not very common at the moment at all. The Land Institute, which helped develop the grain for commercial application, they take a survey every single year. And last year they found it's only on about 2,500 acres out of hundreds of millions that are farmed across the country. And part of that problem is there's just not a lot of consumer demand for the grain, partly because it's not really well known. Tessa Peters is the director of strategy at the Land Institute, and she has some thoughts on how that can change.
Consumers don't really purchase based on environmental messaging. There's a small percentage of consumers that do, but generally speaking. So I think that's where kernza really has an edge, because it actually tastes great.
And what Peters also says is that it could really benefit if a few large food conglomerates or food companies, you know, say like General Mills, for example, if they were to put very small percentage of kernza in some of their best-selling products, it could create more of a demand in the marketplace to grow, to process, to bring kernza to the place where more consumers could, you know, give it a shot. I bought it after I had spoken to Allison Miller for this story, and it didn't arrive until basically when the story was published, and that was almost a month.
Well, Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Eric Schmid is an economic development reporter at St. Louis Public Radio in Missouri. His story was produced in partnership with the Mississippi River Basin Ag and Water Desk. Emergence, flight, migration, immolation. If you're a fan of moths, you'll recognize these words as important stages in their lives. But as a pair of musicians discovered during lockdown in 2020, they can also apply to us too. So they created The Moth Project, a concept album and stage show that combines songs of a whole ecosystem of genres, 80s pop, funk, classical, covers, and even spoken word, combined with stunning photos and videos of these creatures. And they learn that we have a lot more in common with moths than you might think. Sci-fi producer and host of our podcast, Universe of Art, Dee Peterschmidt, sat down with them and has that story.
In 2020, Peter Kiesewalter was at a small family cottage in Ottawa, Canada, taking in the summer night with his brother, Toby.
I'd been watching Toby while I was down at the campfire making another gin and tonic and watching these moths flutter around. And I remember one night saying to him, "What's that about? Why do they go to the light? Why do they go to the flame?" And the first night I saw images from his camera, I was blown away.
In the last few years, I've really been turned on to moths.
Toby is a park ranger and interpretive naturalist for Ontario Parks, and he'd been getting into mothing, which is like birding, but for moths. He learned how to photograph them and showed Peter some of his pictures.
It was absolutely stunning to see. When you zoom in on them, they look like shag carpeting. The amount of hair and colors were just extraordinary.
Peter's a musician based in New York City. He's a Grammy-nominated artist, and he's composed music for ABC News, Monday Night Football, even Winnie the Pooh Show. In spring 2020, he was about to go on tour with another musician, but that fell through when COVID rolled around. So he went up to the cottage in Canada with his family.
What's this one? Holy smokes.
That year, we were all trying to find ways to deal with our anxieties. Some people got really into sourdough bread. Peter got obsessed with moths.
Oh, hello you. That big one. And that one that looks like a leaf. It's not a leaf.
You gotta remember, I'm also a product of where I live, and in Western civilization, they get a bad rap. You know, moths are known as the critters that eat your clothes and have deforested great swaths of forest around the world. So I really didn't know anything about them until I started to think of my own situation and think, what can I create a show about?
And Toby had a book recommendation for Peter, Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer, a botanist and member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. And she brings those two perspectives together into a celebration of the natural world around us. That book helped him see moths in a new way.
You know, in some indigenous cultures, they're casting a completely different light than what we see them as. And in some cultures, they're viewed as guardians of dream time. which is a really cool and beautiful way of looking at them, as opposed to the, like in the Bible or any reference in Shakespeare, always casts them as harbingers of death and destruction.
One of the book's central questions is, what can you give the earth in return for all the earth gives you? This hit Peter hard at that point in the pandemic.
And she says, if you're an artist, create transformative works of art. And that was my epiphany, reading that, saying, aha, I can do that. I can create something to pay back the earth. I saw a similarity between these moths and my own life. I saw resonance also in this whole thing to the flame. I thought, well, I'm kind of like that, and I'm kind of drawn to things that might be harmful to me. I think my parents often thought that I was a bit reckless with the way I lived my life, not really knowing month to month or year to year how I was going to pay the rent and raise a family. But in starting this, I realized this is not going to pay the rent for a few years. But nevertheless, here I go.
His partner, Whitney LaGrange, is also a musician. She's a violinist who plays regularly in Broadway orchestras and with artists like Billy Joel and Smokey Robinson. But when Peter told her he wanted to make a concept album about moths and that he wanted her to play on it, she had a different reaction.
I just said, what? It sounded really weird to me, but the more I looked at these incredible creatures, I just was blown away. I went from what to wow, this is awesome.
So I had to find a way to interpret moths artistically, and I started to find connections between them and us.
Those connections became the track titles on the album, basically taking a stage of the moth's life and relating it to a human experience.
The universal themes of migration, life, death, and especially metamorphosis and transformation. So I started to write some tunes, but also, given the sheer diversity of moths, and there are a lot of them, I wanted the music to reflect that.
Here's one of the first tracks on the album. It's a folky song called Migration.
Got no time to suffer or fail. Gonna hit your ride on a southwind gale.
Some moths make these very perilous migratory journeys. You know, most of them probably don't make it.
There's this one moth called the Death's Head Hawk Moth. It's the same one from Silence of the Lambs. And every year, it travels over 2,000 miles from Europe to Africa to have its offspring.
I saw some parallel story there with my parents.
Peter's parents were born in Germany, and they both grew up during World War II. He told me they had some harrowing experiences. By the end of the war, his dad was 10, and his mom was 6. In the late 1950s, they met while working at a shop in Cologne and got married, but they wanted to leave the country.
A lot of people were getting out of Germany because, it had been pretty decimated.
Gonna join the Exodus, baby, or some major guy.
So they emigrated to Canada and had kids. Some of their family came with them from Germany, but Peter's maternal grandfather, a science teacher, he didn't make it out of the war.
Her only memory of her father is of him pointing out the Big Dipper to her when she's a little kid. And this cottage, when we stand on our dock, it's literally right in front of us, the Big Dipper, during the summer months. It's believed that moths use the stars to navigate at night, which is when they're active for the most part, right?
Scientists believe moths are able to make these long journeys with the help of the moon and the stars. Actually, the reason they circle lights at night is likely because they incorrectly assume it's a celestial object. High-speed footage shows moths constantly adjusting to keep their backs to an artificial light source, just as if it were flying horizontally in relation to the moon and stars.
So it felt like my mom had also been navigated to this place by the Big Dipper, because there it is, and every night she comes down to the dock, she says the same thing. Look, Peter, the Big Dipper.
As you might know, moths have a similar life cycle to butterflies. They hatch, they grow into a caterpillar, and they try to survive until they can spin a cocoon for its metamorphosis. Inside the cocoon, they turn into a kind of soup. Their bodies break down, and then they emerge transformed.
The coming out of these winged adults in these fabulous, incredible colors after trying to stay hidden for the bulk of their life just felt like, there's something here.
Because, you know, when I think of moths coming out of their cocoons, My mind goes to 80s pop, obviously.
I sat on a hard drive for 10 years and I pulled it out and revamped it, and I just felt it lent itself to the word emergence.
You know, I've been shut away in this cocoon a long time. This feeling, this force, it's got a lot of power. And it makes me feel like...
I love emergence. It's just dancing. It's just filled with life.
It seemed to me I was writing sort of a coming out anthem, but it really had a very universal thing of, well, at some point in life, aren't we all trying to annihilate ourselves and emerge as a new human being?
The Moth Project also helped Peter recontextualize some difficult experiences in his life. He reworked another unreleased song called In My Dream that he produced with a Canadian musician years back. She wrote the main song and lyrics, and with her permission, he added this autobiographical section at the top.
Some indigenous cultures believe that moths are the guides of dream time, that you should pay attention if a moth visits you in your dream.
In 1990, Peter and Toby's brother passed away after living with cancer for 3 years.
And that for a few years after his death, I had the same dream every single night for 2 years. And while I was not having a dream about a moth, I was having the exact same dream about my brother every night.
It's autumn. We're walking with his dog, and no one is missing. I'm running along.
So that song sort of frames that experience for me.
I still cry, like, sometimes while we're playing it, because it's a very, very moving piece. And it just shifts into what really does feel like a dream state. It's really beautiful.
In late 2022, Toby was invited to speak at a conference for interpretive naturalists to talk about why interpreters and scientists should collaborate more with artists.
It is such an honor to be up here in front of you tonight
And he convinced the organizers to have Peter and Whitney perform The Moth Project in full for the first time for a big audience, which they'd finished a few months prior. Projected behind them were Toby's photos, along with macro pictures of moths from other scientists and nature photographers that Peter reached out to. But even though Peter and Whitney are no strangers when it comes to performing live, there were some pre-show jitters.
I was really nervous because I thought, well, we're talking about science. I hope we got it right, Peter.
So folks, please welcome from New York City, Whitney LaGrange, Peter Kieselwalter, and The Moth Project.
Listen to my stereo. Come on in.
We have the gift of choice, of story, of love, of gratitude.
Choice, love.
Of hands that make ingenious tools and transform.
Thanks so much.
And then when we finished the show, I felt like a rock star. They're like, woohoo! They had the standing ovation, clapping. They just loved it.
Afterwards, they came up to us more than a handful in tears. The fact that so many scientists were emotionally moved by it was quite a surprise to me.
It made me feel really good, like a stamp of approval. So that was a great show.
I mean, Peter, did you think this would end up being so personal when you started it?
No. I was just trying to find ways to sing, write, talk about moths in a way that meant something to me. And it was slowly became evident that actually, I think this show is about our parents and our family. So it revealed itself slowly to me that, yeah, this is quite personal. And I've never done anything quite so personal before.
If you want to catch The Moth Project live, Peter and Whitney actually have a few performances coming up in Madison, Wisconsin, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Lincoln, Nebraska from October 24th to 26th. You can find out more, listen to the album, and see visuals from The Moth Project at sciencefriday.com/moths. I'm D. Peter Schmidt.
Thanks, Dee. And that's all the time that we have for this hour. If you missed any part of the program or you want to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. Every day now is Science Friday. I'm Kathleen Davis. We'll see you next week.